and welcome to Recovery Internet Radio. The show's so good, people are sliding off the road to get here. We've got a wonderful guest here tonight. Thank you for braving the cold here. I know we're an internet radio station, so thanks for joining us on the internet airwaves. And if you're not from the Chicagoland northern suburban area, you might not know it's a little rough out there tonight. So thanks for being here tonight.
Sure.
I would like to introduce our host tonight and every night, Mr. Rick Atwater.
Thanks. Thank you, Chris. Welcome to Recovery Internet Radio, our show Straight Stuff on Addictions. Tonight, our tag is the Marijuana Maintenance Program, which only captures a very small part of what we're going to talk about, but I thought it might get your attention.
You just like the catchy titles.
I do. I like know the catchy how you roll. Titles. Actually, I like one of my favorites was Crackhead Pinball. Remember that one?
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember how many listens we got that night, but it was pretty good. So anyway, thanks for joining us tonight where we are every Sunday night at 7. And thanks to our engineer, Chris.
Ahoy.
Who's our regular engineer.
Regular something.
And our guest, David.
Hey.
And you can call in if you have any questions or comments or opinions. You can reach us by calling 323-792-2977. That's our regular call-in number. That's 323-792-2977. Or
you can always we can take your calls on air live if you're listening right now. We can also answer tweets if you're on the Twitter thing. You can follow us at Rick Atwater, and I check that, and I'll relay that to the host with the most over here, and you can get your question answered on the air as well.
Yeah.
That's at Rick Atwater via Twitter. You can also find us on Facebook at Recovery Internet Radio. Check our website, recoveryinternetradio.com, the links to all of those locations and access to our archived shows. So if you want to go back and check out that Crackhead Pinball, feel free.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
or any of the shows. And frankly, a majority of the people that listen to us do listen to archived shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's fine. We're glad that you. Whoever you are out there that you're listening, whenever you listen, and we hope that you consider passing the link along to anyone you think could benefit by hearing it or who might be interested in it. That way, that's how we grow. And I know you and I, David, were talking about that you passed it around to the people that you wanted to listen. So that's
right. Welcome, everybody.
Yeah, hi all of David's friends and family.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show.
It's the only way I can get their attention.
Yeah.
Talk to them on the radio.
Well, definitely. Yeah. Well, and it'll be archived, so you can tell them about it later, and they can listen to it again if they didn't listen to it right the first time. A couple of things. Do we have anything we want to mention tonight, or do you want to take care of that at halftime?
You know what? I'd just like to say a quick word about a program that we're involved with. It really got off the ground. Sidekicks Mentoring. It's a volunteer program, absolutely no cost, and we serve youth in adolescents in crisis. Maybe picture Big Brothers and Big Sisters, but they won't let you in. That's where we come in. So we're really looking for kids and for mentors, people that are looking to make a difference and people that need a difference made. So if you know anybody, please check us out at sidekicksmentors.org.
Yeah,
ORG.
It's a good cause. And one quick thing that I want to mention is there is a film called Anonymous People, and it is you can see the trailer for Anonymous People by going to anonymouspeople.com, I believe anonymouspeople.com, and they'll show you what it's about. But basically, it's about the recovery movement, and it's a very interesting film. It's not commercially available. It's not in theaters, but certain people have either purchased it or had it made available to them, and do private showings of it. And there's going to be a showing here in our area in Crystal Lake at the Dole Mansion in the Listening Room on January 22nd at 6:30. So if anybody's interested in seeing Anonymous People, it's really very interesting. I've seen it, and it's startling. So I think I think they use the number 21 million recovering people in the United States.
It's quite a few.
Yeah.
It's a powerful movie. We'd love for you to, if you can make it. What was the date and the time?
January 22nd at 6:30. I don't have the flyer in front of me, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is. And you can always go. Why don't we put the flyer up on the website, our website?
Yeah. You can check Recovery Internet Radio tomorrow, and it'll be up there.
Okay. Ready to roll?
Sure.
Okay. Ready to roll? Yeah? Okay. We're good.
Rolling.
We're all good. Okay. So, I mean, so you and I have had a chance to talk. I mean, we've known each other for a little while anyways.
Sure.
We've had numerous contacts at numerous locations that shall remain nameless at this time.
All good.
Yeah, all good. And so I know a couple things about you, but I believe you told me that you're from a pretty big family.
Sure. I was born into an extremely large family. We were on the southwest side of Chicago, Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
I was the seventh child of what would become 13 children.
Mm.
By the time I was born, life was already a regimented set of rules.
Mm.
Everything was...
That's the way it works with a big family. You've got to run it like a...
Like a team.
Like an organization.
Right,
yeah.
Right. You know, there were wash days for different colors of clothes. There was behaviors for age groups.
Hmm.
And expectations that were without question. So we were all going to church on Sunday.
That was just understood.
Yeah, everybody was going to church on Sunday as a family.
Yeah.
And chores there was expected by age.
Yeah, I remember I asked you you lived in the city, and I said, what neighborhood? And you said, it goes by parish there.
Yeah. Yeah, we were in St. Camillus Parish.
St. Camillus Parish.
There's a lot of them nearby, St. Symphorosa, Our Lady of Snows, St. Renee, and they were all representative of different, basically, communities in the neighborhood.
Yeah, areas of,
right.
Well, what was it like being?
Dad was a mechanic, and he was an independent businessman his whole life. There were times when he worked for other people, but for the most part, he ran his own business. He had just opened up a service garage, gas station when I was young.
Yeah,
and so he provided for the family throughout the entirety of their life together. My mom and dad believed that they had a working agreement. She was in charge. She was the queen of the home, and he was the king of the garage, the gas station.
Right.
The two kingdoms didn't collide. They respected each other.
Yeah.
As long as he kept providing for children, she would have more children. and as long as,
you think they worked it out beforehand, okay, can you cover this?
Oh, no, it was really a fly-by-the-seat-of-the-pants operation. And because he provided for us, he was given allowances that seemed to be cultural, at least in my neighborhood.
Mm.
If the provider came home from work having done his job, he was entitled
to certain...
liberties.
Yeah.
In our home, it was that Dad was entitled to be completely bombed by the time he arrived home.
Mm-hmm.
He'd stop working at 7, and they would drink till into the night, 11, 11:30.
Yeah.
Remember, when he came home, he was a visitor.
Right. He was living in the queen's house then.
Right. At that point, take your shoes off. There were times when we ran away from and hid when Dad came home because we didn't know who was coming home.
Yeah.
Jekyll or Hyde, if he came home into the evening, 7, 8 o'clock at night. But inevitably, it was a consistent theme. He was going to be drinking most of the time.
Yeah. Was that the culture at the time?
Well, actually, I admired that men would come after work to my dad's place, and they'd sit in the back room and drink and talk.
Yeah.
I always wanted that in my life.
Yeah.
That, at some point, I'd be able to hold a court with other people and have conversation. As a child, you don't know the words they're saying. They always change it when the kids are around. It always became about what a good boy he is or he should behave himself.
Yeah, but you knew they were talking about something else.
Yeah,
just before you walked into the room.
And then after I left, you go, go work in the showroom or whatever.
Right.
So, but the other kids' fathers seemed to be drinkers too.
Yeah.
Especially when we had, you know, block parties.
Yeah.
You know, a backyard party. We had graduations going on all the time, or birthdays or something. So we'd be in the back.
It's pretty much, yeah, at least pretty much every month plus.
Right.
You know.
Right. We had a birthday every month except June, Mom and Dad's anniversary. So so there was parties all the time, and they were punctuated by alcohol use.
And it was like, I mean, how did you view that? Did you view that as a problem or troublesome, or was it just the way it was? Or
you can imagine that at some night you're terrorized by the way your father behaves toward your mother or your older brothers, because several of them tried to stand up to him.
Right.
And I remember him pinning at least one of them down on the floor, kind of like taunting him for saying he was going to kill my dad.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're going to kill me? You know. Mm-hmm. Being terrorized by him, you know, shouting at my mom or throwing things around. And then the next morning, he's sitting at the table like, you know, Mr. Cleaver, you know. And Mom is behaving like nothing happened.
And that's that entitlement thing that you're talking about.
Well, what does that mean to you? It means to me that whatever happened last night is part of what is a normal lifestyle.
Right.
My normal included that.
Right. So that was sort of built in for you.
Yeah, the beatings continued until morale improved, you know. You know, and my dad wanted to be proud of us. I mean, at one graduation party, he wanted my brother to perform, you know, and my brother said no, you know. And my dad wouldn't hear of it, but he was so blasted that he beat my brother up, and you know, it was like made a complete fool of himself, and yet after that, we didn't hear about it.
We just forgot about it.
Yeah, we didn't. Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, my brother would have liked it to have been resolved.
Right.
So, the resolution was get bombed. You know,
right.
Drink.
Right.
That's what we do. We're entitled.
Right.
When I went to college and I was trying to get away from home more than I was trying to get an education.
Right.
I had failed to get to the boarding school, the seminary, when I was in grade school, going from grade school to high school because, I found out my mom didn't have any money, but conveniently some girl kissed me before I got to high school. My brother told my mom, and she said, "We're not going."
Now, let me just back up a minute. So she kissed you, or did you kiss her?
No, she kissed me. I never saw it coming.
Just checking.
I was just
never saw it coming out of the blue.
Oh my God! Yeah, you know, it was like
where was I? Because I didn't need to go to the seminary, and it never happened to me. So
I was at that point.
You got kissed, and that was the given reason.
And I was punished by being put into public school for high school.
Then later you found out it was because of the money.
Yeah, and it was like 30 years later.
Right.
You know, and it was almost like by myself, I'm not sure, probably because we didn't have any money. Makes sense.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I get that. Yeah.
Anyway, I went to this cool idea was public school for half a day and then a Catholic school for the other half a day for parents who couldn't afford full-time.
Oh, okay.
So we walked in between schools. I got a girlfriend. It was kind of cool. First year was nice. Got on the cross-country team. And after the first year of high school, we were drinking in between classes, in between schools. One of my friends would raid his dad's liquor cabinet.
Yeah.
And that's where we would test alcohol.
Yeah. Did you like the taste of it?
No, I liked the effect. I mean, he started with slow gin.
Yeah.
It was like a syrupy stuff.
That was a test. Yeah, I know, because who likes the taste when they first drink? When you're a kid, who likes the taste of alcohol?
Well, I never heard anybody ever say, that beer tasted great.
Yeah,
you know,
they just went,
give me another beer.
No, exactly. Slow gin, is that what you said?
Yeah, he was.
It's that red stuff.
Well, we drank it out of film canisters. Who knew?
Film? Is that what he
said? Yeah, the 35-millimeter film canister. He would raid his father's. Yeah,
and pour a little tiny.
That we would just drink it right out of there.
A little shot of.
Yeah. Here's yours, here's mine. Yeah, they were like little, you know, one shot servings.
I never thought of that. That's fascinating.
Ingenious, right?
Ingenious.
Kids these days, they won't know. They got digital cameras. They'll never get that.
They don't even know what 35 millimeter means.
So, But that wasn't my real drinking. My real drinking was 15 years old. Prior to that, I got elected to go to a leadership camp for the Red Cross, and having finished that camp, I was to participate in leadership seminars in Chicago, the city downtown. My parents had this thing: if you were involved in school or an activity, you didn't have to go to my dad's work, my garage.
Didn't have to work there?
Right. Okay. But it had to be an organized activity.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, scouts.
You're all about
Red Cross, cross country.
Right,
you know.
Basket weaving.
Yeah. Can I help you cross
underwater
the street?
Meditation, yeah. Whatever.
I was in the scouts. So Saturday morning I get head down to the meeting. The meeting starts at noon, but I'm going early because it, you know, saves me a half a day of working at the gas station.
Yeah. How do you get? Do you take a bus there?
Yeah. One bus all the way downtown. So I'm going to the building, and I happen to be passing a place where there's a lot of gay bars.
Mm-hmm.
This is my 15 years old wearing my cross country jacket on this, you know, naive blonde haired Southwest Sider. And a guy approached me in his car and asked me if I wanted a ride. So, you know, sure.
Yeah.
These people in Chicago are really nice, you know.
So friendly.
And then he locked me in and molested me.
Yeah.
And he dropped me off in front of the Red Cross building, and I had so much experience in turning off the tragic moments prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the Red Cross meeting and didn't say anything to anybody about it till I got home. And my brother said, "What? A guy did that to you? You're gay. I'm telling mom." You know, so most of my fear was that he was going to tell my mom.
Did he?
Never.
Hmm.
And I didn't, I don't know that she even ever heard about it.
Hmm.
But I didn't have another relationship for 10 years. Hmm. What I did was proceed to get really good at drinking.
Hmm.
Our first...
Because that's the pattern. That's how you do it. Something happens.
Don't know how to deal with it.
Go on to the next day as if it didn't, and then somehow magically it goes away. And the magic apparently for you was largely liquid.
Until a family member came and said, you know, pot, THC, LSD, this is the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the counterpoint to drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And his argument always was that drinking, you know, you're all drunk and hungover, and mm-hmm. you don't have any of that with these things.
Yeah.
You know, and by and large, I mean, there wasn't that heavy, you know.
Sure. You
hangover.
Can just get hazy.
Right, yeah.
Rather than...
drop out, really.
Yeah, rather than whatever.
Yeah, so...
blackout.
So there was this, you know, it was almost like competing doctrine in the same household, you know, and all of it was about avoiding dealing with things.
What would have happened, so you're like still in high school after this happened. What would happen if it got out in your family that you were smoking pot?
My mom knew that my other brothers, among them, first of all, we all knew that there was drinking going on. When my dad caught me drinking at 15, I thought, uh-oh, I'm going to get the crap kicked out of me now.
Right.
And he said, "Behave yourself." And he walked away. And I was shocked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, thinking about it now, it was really because the attitude was we weren't trying to not be alcoholic. We were trying to manage our booze.
Right, that was the message?
Yeah, I mean, if a guy crashed a car, it's he didn't know how to handle his booze.
Right.
It wasn't that he drank too much.
So looking back on it, what did he mean by behave yourself? He meant...
don't get caught.
Don't get caught.
You know?
Yeah, manage it.
You know, he had a friend who would staple a $50 bill to his driver's license, and when he got pulled over, he'd say to the cop, "I bet you $50 you're going to give me a ticket." You know, and he didn't get tickets, and he lost $50 a stop, but he didn't get a ticket.
Yeah.
You know, that was the attitude. Handle your booze. And that was his last resort kind of handling.
And it goes beyond, it really actually goes beyond handle your booze. It goes all the way to handle the consequences of your drink. In other words,
right.
If you're going to drink, make sure you manage all your shit around the around what's going to happen.
I got that message loud and clear.
Yeah. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Staple. Think ahead. Staple the $50 bill, and da, 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 you know, yes, yes, that's yeah, that's very sophisticated.
I did the same thing at the end of my drinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was.
Had it gone up to 100 by then?
Well, I had never. No, I had never done the staple to the driver's license, but I had tried to, instead of get sober, I had tried to arrange my life so the consequences would be eliminated, so that I can continue drinking too much.
How do you do that? I mean, how do you arrange your life so that the I could guess, but why not, how did you do it?
First of all, I became Mr. Mom, which was really great because it was like, you know, my kid needed me. The wife couldn't stay at home with her. So for 3 years, I drank and raised my daughter.
Mm. So you were at home.
At home.
You're not driving. You're not in a public place.
Well,
you're driving a little.
Most of the time I'm not driving. I had to drive to the liquor stores to get booze. And I ran out at the wrong time, so I'd be driving drunk.
Right.
One time with her in the car.
Right.
Well, one time I remember because the cop stopped me, and I got off. I had such a good...
Why did he stop you?
Because somebody had seen me throwing a beer bottle out of the car and reported me.
Oh.
Thank God he didn't look under the front seat of the car. I mean, I had more beer.
Yeah.
But I had a good story. It was managing the consequences. I had the phone book. I had the piece that I was going, you know, it's like, and he said, I said, no, it wasn't me. I said, here's where I'm going. Oh, it's right there. Here's what I'm going to get. It's for my kids. He's backseat sleeping. He let me go.
Huh?
So eventually I got caught.
Oh, you did.
Yeah, eventually I got caught.
But at that time you managed it.
I was,
your dad would have been proud.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing.
I had done the job.
That's the thing. You had done the job. So that's what you learned. So that's the kind of thing, even when you're talking about, so we've moved forward from, you know, from through high school through, and the whole being molested thing is in the background, distant past.
Well, I get a reminder of it when I was 19 in college, you know, got picked up by a couple of novitiate monks at the school where I was studying because 19-year-olds could drink wine and beer.
Mm-hmm.
Officially, I wasn't molested because I was an adult.
Oh, that's
I got taken
that's how that works.
To his cell in the monastery. I don't know how I got there and
right.
woke up with him on me. Was
yeah,
consenting. I presume.
As far as he was concerned, I guess.
Yeah. Well, nothing ever came of it because when he was done, I got dressed and walked to my dorm and proceeded to have my school day. Once again, it was like, you know, close the box, push it aside.
Push it aside.
I'm done dealing with this.
The first incident was was a distant memory and not even a thing. Did you think, had you ever thought that that had affected you?
Not until I was divorced.
And then?
At some point, my divorce was a heartbreaking experience. You know, it destroyed my family. You know, we weren't right for each other.
Yeah.
Two good people weren't right for each other.
Yeah.
But we brought this beautiful kid into the world.
Yeah.
And so after the divorce, I'm reviewing my life, and I realized...
And there's these incidents.
There was a 10-year period after my first molestation where I had no meaningful relationship with anybody.
Of either gender.
Right.
For no friends. Where did
I had friends, but everything was, you know, it really was, you know, I was
like
a scout leader.
Arms length.
So I had the kids that I worked with, and I was, you know, I had friends, brothers, you know, some guys we'd hang around with at college buddies, but I never had that special person who I get to share my life with.
Right.
Why
do you think that was? I mean, what's the mechanics of that?
Well, I have to say that I was prevented from learning enough about myself by my mechanism of avoidance.
Okay, gotcha.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like if all I needed to do was comb my hair, but I was too drunk to see that my hair was uncombed, then I would never know to comb my hair.
Right.
I mean, it's not
that
basic.
You never developed the skills. What it would take to have
my heroes
relationship.
Were the guys who said, you know, I always want to keep a steady high.
Yeah.
You know, always want to be high. Or, you know, put my drunk on.
Yeah.
You know, And if I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I had booze with me, I would drink as much as I could for as long as I could, because my idea was too much is just about enough.
Just about right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was among friends, because like the culture that we had grown up in, where the men were entitled to drink, then, you know, me and my gang, we had done our daily requirement, whatever that was, and then it was time to drink at night, you know. And sometimes it didn't even matter at night.
Yeah.
You know.
So from the time, your experience, you went to Illinois Benedictine.
Right. Then I went to Columbia, finished up there.
Okay. All right.
When I went there, I had recognized that I was way out of control when I was in Illinois Benedictine. I mean, not only was there that experience, but there was the whole lot of weekend drunking and weeknight drinking and
mm-hmm.
and smoking pot as often as I could. And it wasn't working. But there was class reasons as well. It wasn't a good fit for me academically. I started the art department there. I was there when they started it, and for every class I took, I had the same teacher.
Oh, okay.
So I needed
to
change.
And
they recommended Columbia College, and wow, that was great. I got to move back to the city, live at my parents' house. My dad wanted me to get involved with my youngest brother, who is now becoming a scout, and I was allowed to live in his home, with the terms being that I was going to be active in my youngest brother's life.
Mm-hmm.
So scouting, then school.
Mm-hmm.
And that pretty much did it. When I was in school, kind of still quite lost, one of the teachers took me under his wing, made me a teaching assistant, and
mm-hmm.
eventually let me teach one of his classes.
And what did you teach?
Bookmaking. I taught people how to make
binding and
books from scratch. You know, for people who would make scrapbooks and notebooks and sketch pads, and it was a way to give people a real self confidence builder, because they would say, "I can't do it," and say, "Yeah, you can. Give me 4 hours, and you're going to make this book."
What's the kind of binding that Mo has? She had like some of the books she has. This is my wife Mo. She writes books and sort of mm-hmm. makes art pieces out of them, and Shih Tzu box.
Oh, nice. I've never heard of it.
Yeah. Is that right?
Am I saying it right? I don't know.
I know Shih Tzu is a dog, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, I wonder what the dog...
I digress. I'm sorry, but we'll have to get back to that sometime. But anyway, so you're teaching a bookbinding class, and that sounds like it was sounded like it was good for you.
Right. He said to me after one particularly good class, he said, "So what are you going to do now?" And I said, "I'm going to go home and get drunk." He said, "Why?" And I said, "Isn't that what you do? You did a great job. You go home and get drunk."
Heck yeah.
I was really startled that he didn't recognize that that's the normal process.
Because that's how deeply normal it was to you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It really was.
Was that like the first recognition or the beginning of a recognition that what you were doing wasn't normal? Or had you known that already?
Oh, that's a good question. There was a guy who had driven me home from my dad's gas station. He often had to get us guys to drive us home because we were kids in school days and school nights, and dad was going to be out for a while. And one of them, I said, "Well, you know, my brother had influenced me about, you know, pot was a better alternative than drinking." And he said, "Oh, man, those guys are going at it." And I go, "Yeah, they should be smoking pot." And he said, "Why?" I said, "Because, you know, it's better than beer." He says, what about the possibility of neither?" And I looked at him like, you know, when did aliens land?
What are you talking about? What?
I remember he was driving this really sweet Pontiac with this like romantically beautiful dashboard. And you know, it was like a Catalina back in the 60s, 70s. I mean, it was really this neat car. But I thought, "Dude, you are a communist." Those two guys, those two voices were the two in the long line of, like, this is normal, that were not, who spoke to the, it's not normal.
Okay. I think what we'll do is we'll take a short breather here.
Yeah.
And play a little, what are you going to play for us tonight?
It's by Walk the Moon.
Walk the Moon.
The name of the song is Anna Sun. It's that kind of a summery kind of thing, which doesn't really fit well on a cold January night, but you know what? I like it. So.
Okay, so you're going to play it because you like it, darn it.
Yeah, thank you for being with us here tonight. We're going to take a short break, and we will be back in five. Thanks for joining us here at Recovery Internet Radio, and we'll catch you in just a moment.
Falling off the door, door hanging off the hinges. My feet are still sore, my back's on the fringes. We tore up the walls, we slept on couches. We lifted this house, we lifted this house. Firecrackers in the east, my car parked out. Your hands on my cheek, your shoulder in my mouth. I was up against the wall on the west mezzanine. We rattle this town, we rattle this team. We're
I wanted to mention some friends of ours. Let's see, who we got? We've got Dirty Laundry Designs.
You know, can I interrupt just really quick? Because I think we came back, and the mic might not have been on for your reintroduction.
Oh, okay.
So welcome back, everybody.
Okay. Okay. Well, I was just going to go do a couple of quick shout-outs to our friends. Dirty Laundry Designs, Fresh Cards for Addiction and Recovery. You can contact Colleen at Dirty Laundry Designs. They make really cool cards for recovery occasions. We also have some friends that are in a band called Double Take, and you can find out what Double Take is doing by going to DoubleTakeChicago.com, I believe.
Yeah, it's cool. They have some a little playlist of some of their music. You can hear some of their original tracks.
Yeah.
They do a lot of covers, but you can hear them actually play. Good music. Good times.
Yeah, good times. Good times. Okay, so how about we get back to our conversation?
Sure.
Shall we? You ready for that?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, one of the things that I had asked, we had talked a little bit about is, I think you had had a run-in with a recovery program somewhere early
right.
in your, what, how did that happen and when?
I'm not sure of the exact date, but I was back on the southwest side of Chicago, and
were you still going to Columbia, or was it after that?
I think this was before I even got to Columbia. I think this was during my drinking at the first school.
Okay.
My eldest brother took me to my first AA meeting.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember him staying inside or if he
dropped
me
off. Just got you there?
Yeah. Because of all the brothers, he was like the most responsible, serious, like... You know, he's the archetypal first son.
Yeah,
he's got 12 behind him. You know,
right?
You know,
right.
He's the first child.
Yeah.
So I'm at this meeting, and I remember being possessed by a judgment against everybody.
Mm.
They're replacing booze with coffee and smokes.
Mm-hmm.
The place was a cloud.
Sure.
What did they say? Did it matter? It was them versus me.
Yeah.
And I'm not one of them.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't exact. You weren't joining up.
No. Yeah. No. The smoke I smoked wasn't allowed in that room. You know. They didn't. You know.
Right.
Yeah. So, and it didn't make sense. So.
There was some irony there that you're pissed off at smokers, but
yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, that was the one and only visit prior to. The real trouble I caused myself.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, so that, I just want to, because I know we had spoken about that before, and I just wanted to, you know, it's like, your brother must have known something.
Oh, I'm sure he wasn't the only one. I constantly, throughout the course of my adult life, believed I was owed something.
Hmm.
So, when my parents kicked me out, I just showed up at another brother's door and expected him to take me in.
Mm.
And he did. The guy's, you know, just great. Thank you, God, for
yeah.
my brother, you know. And he never liked me having me around. He never would have said, hey, come on and live with me.
But
like,
when you showed up.
Yeah, it was like, all right, whatever. You
yeah.
know? And the last time I showed up at his place was in 88.
Mm.
And by the beginning of 89, he, like, had enough of my crap and said, you got to do something. And so,
So what did he see?
Well, I think he, what did he see? I was avoiding making any commitment to a real life. I was a really good photo assistant. I worked with some of the great photographers in Chicago. I had worked my way to the place where I was respected in my field, but I was always able to work just enough to get by and not much more. Then I connected with a guy who was a photographer who basically his photography studio was the front so that he can get women.
Yeah.
You know, and he manipulated me into thinking that I was going to be able to build my business there, which was more slavery for him. And, you know, it was like he got free work out of me. And what little time I had available to work on developing my clientele was, you know, it was always going to be models and actors for their headshots, and there was no money in that. So I was really always scraping the bottom.
Mm.
And
so that's what he saw.
He saw
like
that, yeah. I was
a going nowhere guy.
Well, and drinking my ass off and,
right.
you know, and being altered as much as possible, not
yeah.
contributing to home life.
Right.
You know, and so I went to ACOA.
Hmm.
First meeting was on January 1st of
1989. Mm-hmm. And that's just for those who don't know, adult children of alcoholics.
Right. Obviously, I had a problem with my dad's drinking.
Right.
It messed me up.
Right.
You know. So without anybody making me, I made a commitment to not drink. So from that day,
while you were going to ACOA?
Right. And then, you know, it was a beginner's meeting, and, you know, and so we covered the first three steps. It was a large meeting over at the Northwestern Hospital's cafeteria or something,
mm-hmm.
you know, Sunday mornings. It was kind of cool,
mm-hmm.
you know. Met a therapist through there, and she offered a group therapy for working the 12 steps of adult children of alcoholics. So I took it and went
mm-hmm.
through it and graduated, got a certificate, you know, I was
mm-hmm.
qualified. So
even though you didn't really need the certificate, my friend.
Or
you know. or the you hadn't even found out what graduation was yet.
No. So there I was, and September 5th I met a woman who I married 5 weeks later.
Wow.
And one of the things that she liked about me was I wasn't drinking.
Oh. Was she also an ACOA? You didn't meet her there.
She
was
I didn't. The one woman I did meet at ACOA reminded me never to date in the program. You know, this is kind of, wow.
Yeah.
But that's another story altogether. I mean, it was a lot of self-hatred, and it was directed at me because I was the nearest person, and our time was peppered with this real hate speech. And then, mm-hmm. call me, you know.
yeah.
I love you. Call me. No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
But I met this woman, and she was just, you know, perfect for me, and I was perfect for her. We got married and had this great kid. And at some point during the first few months of our marriage, somebody gave me a bottle of champagne for a job well done.
Mm.
And my wife said to me, let's have the champagne. I said, I don't drink. I had actually been working as a bartender at Excalibur, not drinking. and I think that's the reason they kept me, because I stunk as a bartender.
But you didn't drink up the profits. So.
And I was able to narc on everybody who was, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, you know. And so the bartenders hated me, and the management loved me. They wanted to keep me around, and I wasn't drinking. So, but we had gotten this bottle of champagne, and she said to me, come on, let's drink it. I said, I don't drink. She said, what harm could it do? And I said, you're absolutely right. What harm could it do?
Yeah.
And we drank that champagne, and with that, the floodgates opened. From 1989 until 1998, I proceeded to drink and smoke dope as much as I could, as often as I could. It was like I had never stopped. And the cool part about me being married to a flight attendant was when she was gone, she didn't know how bad it got.
Yeah.
There was one time.
You could hide it. Yeah.
Well, one time the trip canceled and she showed up back at the house and I've got, you know, the porno videos and I got the cigarettes and I got the booze and I got a bag of reefer. And she, what the hell's going on? I thought you were on a trip. This is my time.
This
you know,
is a party. Don't you understand?
So, I always declared I was an honest person, and she was the one who pointed out to me, are you honest when you drink on the way to the liquor store to get us wine and buy an extra bottle, a 40-ounce bottle, and drink it on the way home so you can drink a little bit of wine with me and not...
And have her think that that little bit of wine was the only alcohol that you were drinking, when
right.
in fact you were drinking before and after.
Right, I mean, and that
she
I wouldn't
it.
See it in the garbage cans, and
right.
she'd ask herself that.
So she knew that.
Yeah, she was clear about that. And there was enough fights where, you know, they ended up with, you know, it doesn't really matter what's right or wrong with our marriage. The fact that you're drinking makes us, as a couple, unable to resolve whatever it is.
Why
that's
did
wrong
she want a person that wasn't drinking in the first place?
I don't know that she wanted. She just liked the fact that I wasn't.
Right.
She had been divorced. She was married to a musician for a while. And I don't know, you know, why they broke up or whatever. You know, I just think that they had grown apart.
Okay.
And, but yeah, she didn't know what alcoholism was like in my family.
Right.
And her own family history, that's hers, you know.
Yeah.
Certainly there's probably some alcoholism that affected her somewhere down in the ancient past.
Yeah. I mean, the only reason I ask is just because normally that's not, you know, somebody would prefer a non-drinker. There's usually, they have their own reasons for that, whatever,
yeah.
their own experiences with their stuff or somebody else's in the past.
She certainly had experiences.
So she already had a mindset that it would be better if she was married to somebody that didn't drink.
And then when I became a drinking guy, and it went right from 0 to 60.
Right. I bet you she was shocked.
Hurt.
Is the word.
When you know,
like that's betrayal. I mean, that's like
totally.
You told me you didn't drink, and now what?
Yeah.
You're drinking like a fish for 10 years or 11 years or however many years.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, and that just ended up destroying the marriage. That
right. I mean,
other things.
You know, I got to the point where you know I was watching the kid and drinking because it was permission was granted. There was you feed this child, you nap this child, you change diapers, and you prevent her from putting her fingers in the electric socket, and you're pretty much done.
Yeah.
Now, I was really an active dad. I doted on my child, and I did whatever I could.
Right.
But I felt entitled to drink.
Yeah.
You know, so...
Yeah, and it reminds me of what you said about your dad, in a way. Like, if he did what he was supposed to do, he was entitled to drink.
Right. And, you know, the problem for me was... I would drink while I was watching my kid.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we had a stroller, so I didn't have to drive, you know. So, you know, the DUI.
You can drink and walk.
DUI for a stroller, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. What do they call that, a TUI? I don't know. An SUI? I don't know.
Trollery. Anyway, I remember one time she was still a baby, and I was supposed to be giving her a bath, and I had been drinking hard liquor. Probably because I didn't have a chance to get to the liquor store. It was too early in the day. And so I'm drinking clear liquid alcohol. And she's in the tub, and I'm filling the tub, and I'm so jacked that I faint.
Mm.
And the water's filling.
Yeah.
And... thank God I hit my head hard against the porcelain of the tub, and it brought me back too.
Right, but if you hadn't?
I would have killed my kid that day.
Yeah.
And that was near the end.
Yeah.
That was near the end. It was like, you know, I did get a DUI, and I did drive on a suspended license, and I did, you know, the trouble I caused myself was because I drove on that suspended license for 3 months. We went to Houston, and I rented a car and drove on that suspended license in that car. If we would have stopped in Houston, my wife was at a conference, and I've got the kid and me, and we're spending our days together, and now Daddy's in jail.
Right. You know? That could have gone very badly.
It went badly as it was. I got stopped in Lake in the Hills, the nearby community. Anyway,
So what launched you finally back into the program?
What got me to get started was in 1998, as a child-raising parent at home, I had tried everything I could to stop drinking, or to not even stop it, but to make it not be so impactful, negatively impactful on my life.
Right.
Neighbor said, well, just, you know, drink less. I was like, I tried.
Yeah.
Drink water in between drinks. I tried. You know, my dad had this thing was, you know, not before 7 o'clock at night, then it became not before 5 o'clock, then it's, you know, 5 o'clock somewhere. That was kind of my thing. You know, there was no parameters I could set by which drinking was okay. The last day of my drinking, I figured I had it totally worked out. I had done all the house cleaning. I had done all the dishes. The house was ready. We were having a block party that I could walk to.
Hmm.
And my wife was at home, and she promised to take my daughter from the time the party started till the end of the day.
So I had every single base
covered.
I had
covered it.
That is called managing your drinking right down the line.
I got a gold star.
Your dad would be proud.
It was a gold star moment for me.
Mr. C, wherever you are, your son
he did
finally
it.
Made it.
Yeah, yeah. And the block party ended before the tapper ran dry.
Mm.
So one of the neighbors said to me, we're going to go finish this at the neighbor's house. You want to join us? Wow, I made it.
Sure.
Not only am I drinking, but I'm welcome in this community to join them for their party. So we went and we continued to drink into the night, playing penny poker and drinking and drinking. And I was so drunk that we drank the tap dry and then they opened a bottle of Miller Genuine Draft and put it right in front of me. And I never, ever even lifted the bottle. I was so buzzed. But I knew it was time for me to go after I suggested that we play strip poker with all their wives.
Yeah, right.
Seemed like a great idea to me.
Yeah, I remember you telling me that. I was laughing. Yeah, you play strip poker with other guys' wives.
Yeah,
I love that.
That I didn't get beat the hell there. It surprises me.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were all drunk, too. But, you know, then it was time for me to bomb an O's, you know.
Mm-hmm. Got to run.
I got it, really.
Yeah.
It was only a block and a half away, but I stumbled, hit several trees on the way, and got home and passed out in the living room. My wife found me there and startled me awake, and it was a weird experience. I felt under pressure. Like I was in a balloon, and everything that she said was like somebody putting a finger into the balloon. It was just extra pressure.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what she was saying, she, as far as I know, she was saying, "Are you all right? You don't look good." But what I was hearing is something. You look bad, you know. And it was really.
Right.
So I ran out of the house and I went, found the car door open, and passed out on the floor of the car. She called the cops. And they came over, and she said, "I'm really worried about him." And the cop said, "Well, if he's in his car and he has his key, we're going to have to arrest him."
Right.
Fortunately, I had walked, and so the final, you know, the silver lining on the gold star was that they weren't going to arrest me because the keys were hanging up, and I didn't have them. So I flipped it off. And the next day, I think it was Labor Day weekend, I really felt like crap. But I was also not only the physical. You know, the immense headache, that nauseous feeling all day. I hadn't had that plenty of times, and, you know, hair of the dog will take care of that.
Sure.
Or make you some other place. But the day was marked by isolation. She left me alone.
Mm.
And toward 3:30, she came up to me and said, "What are you going to do now?"
Mm-hmm.
And walked away. She didn't even want an answer.
Right. What are you going to do? Not what are we going to do?
It was not her problem.
All right.
And I wanted the heat turned down. I wanted to not feel like this. And I had a moment of clarity. And that meeting that I had attended where those guys were smoking and drinking coffee seemed like a better alternative than what I had here.
Yeah.
That there was a thing called AA. ACOA had told us enough about what AA was. It seemed like I had finally qualified. And so I said to her, "I'm going to AA."
Mm-hmm.
She said, "Good." Like she could really care.
Yeah.
And I started going. I went 90 meetings in 90 days, 120 meetings in 120 days, whatever. I went to a meeting a day.
Yeah.
And stopped drinking that day. I haven't had a drink since then. But I'm a smart guy. And I am a legalist like anybody else. I'd be willing to shoot angles. I'd be willing to look for a loophole. And I found one. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking.
Mm.
So I started working with a sponsor, I think it was about 8 months into it. And I admitted to him that I was smoking pot. And he said to me, "Why don't you stop?" I agreed I would try to stop. And I tried for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And decided I didn't like not smoking pot. So I went back to it. But I made sure I didn't tell him.
Yeah.
for 4 years.
Yeah, and so just one quick connection. Remember the title of the show, the Marijuana Maintenance Program, right?
And this is where it begins.
This is where it begins.
Sorry for the long introduction.
Well, that's okay. That's what we have to have the whole thing.
I had stopped drinking, but I wasn't at a real bottom because I just didn't want consequences. And AA gave me that license to continue smoking pot. My sponsor didn't, but he thought I was walking the straight and narrow.
Yeah.
And I avoided any, I avoided ever lying outright.
Mm-hmm.
At my, I went to meetings. I was, I wasn't sponsoring anybody. No, I wasn't. I was going to meetings. I was home groups, you know, regular meetings that I attended with the same people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was smoking pot in between. I think I may have bought pot a couple times in those 4 years, but most of the time it was when I was with friends. I was on campouts. Got arrested once for possession on a campout, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't stop me.
And how long did you go that way?
4 years.
Yeah.
It was toward the end of the time that I recognized, I actually had the opportunity to buy, and I bought, you know, some amount.
Yeah.
Half ounce, quarter ounce, something. And I found myself going through it, burning through it, at a remarkable pace. Having been the guy who only could smoke when somebody had it, and they,
yeah.
you know, they'd portion out a single hit.
Yeah.
You know, I take a puff and I'm done. Now I've got abundanza, you know, an abundance of it, and it's like it's not enough. You know, so I'm burning it all day long, and it was during that time in the midst of my inebriation with it that I recognized that I was doing with pot what I had done with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And
it had progressed.
It just became the replacement.
Yeah.
I was going to meetings, and at the time I was in a home group where the people in that room did not represent what I saw myself becoming as an adult.
Yeah.
They had many years, but what they had, I'm not going to judge them. It wasn't what I wanted.
Yeah.
So I stopped going, and that was my license to not going to meetings at all. So starting sometime late in 2002, I stopped going to meetings because I had it figured out.
Right.
I wasn't going to be like those guys. And I had my drug, which was marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you were just going to do the kind of...
Like, I got it handled.
Smoke some pot and not drink. And,
yeah. And I don't, who needs meetings? They're talking about drinking. I don't drink.
Right.
I was working for a guy at the time who had given me an opportunity to come back from being Mr. Mom by allowing me to build for him, do construction work. He was on a very limited income for the project, so he couldn't afford to have a whole crew. So, and design decisions were coming slow anyway, so it was kind of a perfect blending. I'd work for him, write my own hours. He could afford to pay me. The project went slowly along, but it was proceeding. And he didn't care if I smoke or drink on the job. Well, I didn't drink, but
mm-hmm.
you know, I smoked. And then there was a point at which he said, you know what, this isn't working. You can't be working here smoking pot. And so... I was shocked because I had worked for him for years in photography.
Yeah.
And, you know, we never smoked during photography jobs, but
yeah,
this is just construction, you know.
Yeah.
So, but he said, no, you can't smoke if you want to work for me. And so the last time I did smoke pot, I was working for him. I finished the day's work and found the stash. And figured I'm entitled. Hmm. Now, at that time, I was drinking a lot of coffee because I wasn't drinking, and I was smoking cigarettes because I, you know, because they're legal. You know,
sure.
God for, you know, whatever. They're still legal. Then I smoked pot, and my heart started racing, and I threw up, and I felt sick, and I realized that I was in the same boat I had been in drinking now with pot.
Yeah.
And I went out on the guy's back porch, and I'm sitting there, and I I look down and my fingers are pointing at each other about a half inch apart from each other. And I think of that picture on the Sistine Chapel of the finger, God and man reaching out. And I said, God, I can't do this alone. Help me. God, help me.
Mm.
I want to live. And at that moment, I made a decision. I was done.
Mm.
I haven't smoked pot since. I haven't done mind-altering drugs since.
Mm-hmm. And when was that?
Sometime in April of 2003. I say that my sobriety date is May 1st so that there's no, scrutiny about it.
Yeah.
It's an easy day to remember.
Sure.
So...
better than April Fool's Day anyway, I think.
I had plenty of those. I don't think it was just April. Good morning, another Fool's Day.
Just kidding. Yeah, my sobriety date's April 1st. Just kidding.
Yeah.
May 1st, better, yeah.
Yeah, so I had a friend come and take me home, and then I went back to the home group and said to them, well, first off, I didn't tell them. I continued to lie for another week or two and got another sponsor, and he's defending me because these guys were, bitch slapping me for being gone for 6 months or whatever. And finally I took him aside and I said, I was smoking pot. At which point he said to me, you really should find something that works for you. We don't smoke pot. You don't want what we got. I can't be your sponsor. I was devastated.
Hmm.
More than that moment on the back porch was the moment when I was rejected by the people of AA because I wasn't willing to do what they asked.
Yeah.
I asked another guy to sponsor me, and then I proceeded to ignore him for a month. And when he finally caught up with me, he said, I'm not your sponsor. I said, why not? He says, because you don't call me.
Mm.
Good luck. So I got another guy and asked him, and he said, sure. And... we talked a few times, and I realized I'm not doing this. I'm in a very dangerous spot.
Right.
So I finally found a guy who I kept as a sponsor for 8 years.
Mm.
And we sit down with him, and I said, "All right, I was in AA for 4 years before I got to this place, and now I'm ready to work the program. Here's my story." And I told him, I said, I don't want to have any secrets with you.
Beginning to end.
You got to know all about me.
Right. And then he was ready to help.
Right there. He says, I can't help you if I don't know where you are.
Right.
So don't lie. Don't omit anything. Tell me the story.
Yeah.
And he was my sponsor for 8 years. I went back to the home group and admitted that, they had already known. But I said, all right, I want what you got. Because what you've got is, there was a different group. There was a Friday night home group and a Thursday night. The Friday night home group was really solid guys.
Mm-hmm.
Roger was in that group and some other guys. And some of them were still doing it, that Friday night group. And
don't take yourself too seriously, Roger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rule 62.
Yeah.
And he I came back and I said, all right, I'm in. Count me in. They said, okay, we don't smoke pot. I said, all right, I don't smoke pot. I said, I drink non-alcoholic beer, right? And they said, what? And I said, non-alcoholic beer. Somebody pointed out, well, there's alcohol in non-alcoholic beer. I said, yeah, but do the math.
Right.
12 bottles equals enough alcohol as one beer.
Right.
And I used to drink a case of beer to get loaded, so we're talking a case times 12, so I'd have to drink 12 cases of beer to get bombed.
Right, not to mention how many times you'd have to take a leak.
Right, right. Yeah. And they looked at me and they said, it's got alcohol in it. Why do you want to drink something that tastes like what you used to use to get drunk?
Right.
I said, I don't know. They said, non-alcoholic beer is for non-alcoholics.
Mm.
We don't drink non-alcoholic beer. And I said, I completely disagree with you, but I want what you got. And so despite the fact that I disagree with you, I'm going to do what you suggest, and I won't drink
non-alcoholic beer. And that sounds to me like, the turning point, the point at which you were willing to do whatever it would take, whether you liked it or not.
It was like some people, they hit the bottom and they bounce right up. I kind of like was an airplane in a dive.
And skidded a little bit.
Yeah, touched the water a few times and then, pulled out and, touched it again and then slowly the rise took place.
Let me ask you a couple of things, and then we probably need to talk about wrapping this, but what would you say about the difference between your sober life and your life as an alcohol and drug user? I mean, what's different for you now?
Oh my God, everything's different. I'm not a spectator in my life. Decisions aren't being made around me to prevent me from hurting myself or others.
Mm.
My family and friends don't avoid inviting me to things or making sure they put away the good stuff so that
I don't
wreck it.
Yeah.
I don't have to, there's no fear I'm going to break the hot tub again or pee in the garage between the screens or pee out the second story window. The champagne glasses aren't going to be shattered because I stumbled.
Yeah.
The kids are going to be safe.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to be able to hold a conversation with somebody.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to be able to make a decision. My life has changed completely.
You don't have to lie anymore either, do you?
The truth doesn't change. And so when I can tell my story like I'm telling you today, I'm telling you the same story.
Yeah.
There's probably parts of it that some people haven't heard and probably for their own good,
Yeah. But it's the truth.
It's the true story. After getting sober, 5 years sober, my marriage ended.
Mm.
And the good news about that was, as a sober guy, I asserted that it would be best for my daughter that she live with me in her home. And that's what I got. Mm. I've had relationships with people since my marriage. And in the truest form of sobriety, I've been present in the now for these relationships. And now I'm in with someone I truly love, and it's been remarkable because I'm present.
Yeah.
And
it's hard to have a relationship with somebody else when you're having an intimate relationship with a substance.
And all the baggage you carry
and
with
all
it.
All the baggage that comes with that, exactly.
There was a time in this woman I'm with, Rini, is really fine. But early in the relationship, she scared me because it seemed a lot like something in my past.
Mm.
Sober guy talked to her. It took me a while, but I talked to her, and what a difference it made.
Mm.
Drunk guy, stoner guy would have hightailed it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, categorized it as her problem. What she wanted was totally unreasonable.
Right.
Turns out we wanted the same thing.
But sober guy...
Came back.
Yeah, stays in the
game. Acknowledged the mistake, that avoidance, that a week long of avoidance because I was so afraid, but then talked.
Let me, I think that's really those are some really good things, and I know in the program I think they talk about some stuff called the promises, and maybe not all of them are in those last statements, but some of them are.
Yeah.
You can sort of extricate some of the key ones. But one, I guess I kind of want to ask maybe one final question, and that is, I know we were going to talk a little bit about the legalization matter, and I think we're going to skip that tonight because that's a whole...
Okay.
That's a whole other, whole other ball.
Legal or otherwise, I'm not using it.
Yeah. So for you, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it's not my battle to fight. I hope that whoever's using it isn't driving.
Yeah, and doing it responsibly like you would do anything else. Other... things that normal people do.
Yeah.
We don't really know that much
about. I've already done my share. I'm good.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks.
So if there were some people out there, that were listening that maybe were thinking about getting sober, they heard your story, maybe they were in the early part of their recovery and they have some questions in their head, what would be a couple of the main things that you would suggest to people? To those folks, either early recovery or somebody who's considering recovery, what would you say to them?
2 weeks before I got into AA, I thought I had it figured out. I thought I could manage my drinking. When I finally hit the bottom, and the bottom took me 4 years to hit completely, because I stopped drinking 4 years before I got sober.
Yeah.
And hitting the bottom, I recognized that if I'm only looking in the mirror, I'm always going to get the same answers. And I'm not the smartest guy in the room. There's a blind spot in me that relates to alcoholism and drug use. And I can't see myself using it appropriately. I don't know what that looks like. I never will, and I don't care. I don't mind that I won't. What I found out that I could live in the Garden of Eden as long as I don't eat from that tree.
Yeah. Right.
But it's still the Garden of Eden.
Right.
I have work potential, fulfilling relationship potential. I have a lifestyle that is actually worth living. I guess the hardest part was humility to take direction from somebody else.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest hurdle was acting before I understood. Somebody came in and said, do this. This is how it works. Somebody said to me, this is how it works. And I said, why does it work? They said, this is how it works. Not why it works. This is how it works.
Right.
And that's the hardest message to get to somebody new. We're not going to tell you why it works. We're going to tell you how it works. Because if you do this, it will work.
Mm-hmm.
I knew a guy who spent 10 years trying to figure out why and wasn't sober. And the minute he started listening to how it works and doing that, he got sober. And 2 years later, he now understands why it works.
Yeah.
But that's something you find out in the rearview mirror.
Right. It's like a lot of times putting something together is difficult. But if you follow the directions, it, you know, it's a pain in the neck, but it usually works.
Right. And I think that the... If I was going to share with somebody who's trying to think if it's for them or not, or somebody who's new in sobriety, you're surrounded by people who know you because they know themselves. And if they have recovery and if they aren't drinking and they are working on any kind of realistic program of recovery, you can trust them.
Hmm.
But you have to feel comfortable with them enough to trust them. But you can tell if you go to enough meetings with these people and you listen to them and you listen to what people say about them and to them and who talks to them, you'll get a sense of who the person is you can trust,
yeah,
who knows you. Because there will be a time in your sobriety when they will say something that you categorically disagree with. I know, I did.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I was at the junction of... or the intersection of, right, do I do my will or do what they want?
I disagree with you, but I will do it.
Made all the difference in the world to me.
Well, David, thank you for coming out tonight. I appreciate it. You and Reed, very nice.
Thanks for having us.
Nice.
I'm humbled by it. And
nice job. Very nice job. Good message. And we've got a couple of things we want to say in closing, and then we'll shut her down tonight, because good heavens, we got to pull you out of the ditch.
Any listeners out there listening live in the area?
Yeah, if there's anybody else out there that has chains, it's
we almost made it all the way here.
Yeah, it was like how far are you?
Like 500 feet. I mean, just right there.
Anyway, thanks tonight to David and also to Rini for being here, and thanks to our listeners. For making us a successful little underground support source for the recovering community. We'll email out our reminders for next week's show, usually Thursday or Friday. We get lucky, sometimes Saturday, if we don't. We try to look at recovery from a wide and open perspective, so we have a wide range of ideas and thoughts here, and you know, those thoughts belong to the people that express them. Remember, please, to check recoveryinternetradio.com. That's
recoveryinternetradio.com
for all our archive shows and to sign up for our email reminder list. We hope you do sign up for that list and do log on to Recovery Internet Radio, because we
very
want
nice,
to know.
Very nice weekly email. I mean,
it's
graphics.
Really,
it's
sweet.
Yeah,
it is.
Nice.
I might vary it this week, though, just for the heck of it. But anyway, but we would like to know where our listeners come from. So if you log on and get onto our email list, we would know that. Because we're an internet radio show, we don't know where the heck you are. So we'd love to hear from you. And as always, live today, love yourself and your neighbor, and together we'll trudge the happy road to destiny. We hope you've enjoyed the show tonight, and we'll see you at 7 p.m. next Sunday night. Thanks.